This is Pamela Banos, and I'm speaking with Russell Lewis, the Executive Vice President and Chief Historian at the Chicago History Museum, formerly known as the Chicago Historical Society. Thank you for agreeing to meet with me to talk to me about my Hidden Truths project and for allowing me to publish this on the internet. So can you tell me a little bit about your history here at the museum? And I know from looking at your biography online that you've had a number of different positions over time.
Sure. I've been at the museum for 25 years. I started in 1982 working in the publications department, and I worked there for 10 years. And then for the last 15, I moved to the collection side, became very involved in the curatorial collecting side of the museum's activities, and then sort of moved into more administrative roles, and I've served as acting president a couple times, and then 2 years ago I was made executive vice president and chief historian.
What does chief historian mean exactly?
Chief historian means that I answer the questions that people don't know the answers to, and that I review a lot of things. You know, basically that job is to make sure that we're as much as possible historically accurate. You know, I make connections to people that they might not think of, some aspect of the city's history or somebody who's doing work out there that I know. I have one foot in the museum and one foot in the academic world, and that I'm very tied into a lot of the historians in the Chicago area and what they're doing. So I try to make connections to people who want to do research or want to know who's doing what, or interviews, or, you know, if there's a reporter who's doing a story and wants to talk to somebody who has some expertise, and then our own staff trying to get the right people to come in to consult with us.
So that's interesting, because I remember when I met with you for the first time last April, so almost a year ago now, and I told you a little bit about what I was doing with this project. You mm-hmm. mentioned to me at that time that I probably knew more about the Chicago Cemetery than anybody, and I was surprised to hear that. And so why do you think that is?
Well, most historians that work in the city, they tend to, I'll give you a good example. We get a lot of people here who want to know, who are fascinated by the story of the Chicago Fire, and, you know, did Mrs. O'Leary's cow actually start the fire? And we know that the story that circulated almost from the beginning about how her cow kicked over the lantern was a fabrication that a journalist created, and he later recanted. And then we know Mrs. O'Leary was exonerated by the city council some years ago. But what a lot of people don't understand is that historians don't really care who started the fire. We don't know to this day who started the fire. They're more interested in what was the massive effort by the city to recover. That's what historians tend to be more interested in. People who have a passion and an interest in an aspect of history that are maybe not interested in those kind of questions, they focus on more of those sort of details. And a lot of academic historians, they don't want to talk to those people. But they usually come here. They come to see me. Mm-hmm. I like them. I like talking to them. I enjoy it. I've met a lot of them. I've learned a lot from them. They explore some things that historians have decided that story is done. There's nothing more to tell or whatever. And people like you and your interest, you kind of drill down in a way that most historians don't. And I think, being an artist, I think you have a different way of thinking about things. And I think it's really helpful, and it allows you to put things together in a way that a historian wouldn't. So when I met you and I heard about what you were doing, and, you know, I was just really kind of stunned by the depth and the breadth of what you knew already, mm-hmm. and that kind of just kind of relentless kind of effort to kind of gather up as much information, not giving up. As I said, I know other people who were like that, and you know, for me it was clear that, you know, you knew more about this, and, you know, I go into my brain and think about my Rolodex, well, who else is working mm-hmm. on this? And there really isn't anybody. There is Helen Sclair. I don't know if you met her. She's known as the cemetery lady. Mm-hmm. and she used to do a lot of, she knows a lot about a lot of the cemeteries, but I don't know if she knows as much as you did about this particular cemetery.
So do you think that information about Chicago before the fire is part of this? Because I was amazed that I didn't find any of this information, and then further amazed that, well, when they discovered that cache of information about from the Common Council fires, mm-hmm. that files right. that they found in 1983,
right.
That there was a lot of information that people didn't have access to until recently. And I was kind of amazed that it's actually been the internet that has given me most of or a lot of what I have found.
Yeah, it's, well, of course, with the fire, a lot of records were destroyed, and everybody thought that these records, in fact, I know the person that found them, and he tells a really, you know, great story of how he discovered these things in a warehouse. But nobody knew they existed. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, the internet has been, if you know how to use it, and I think if the internet gives you access to these things, but you still have to be able to interpret them and connect them. And that's the real key. I think a lot of people think that, you know, getting access to everything is, you know, is a dream. Well, you know, you can be overwhelmed. Right. It can be very conflicting. So you really have to know how to sort of interpret it. But it really has helped a lot. And, you know, another example is we were asked by Alderman Burke to weigh in on a person who made a claim that a constable named James Quinn was the first police officer killed in the line of duty. And he had done a lot of work with IROD and finding the documents and the widow's application for relief, you know, and the committee that looked at, you know, her claim and this kind of stuff. And again, here's somebody who had a tub full of documentation on this that I didn't know anything about this. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who it was, and it started when he was doing research on some of his ancestors and looked who were police officers, and he saw this name, and he knew this person wasn't a Gold Star police officer killed in line of duty, and he developed a whole incredible body of research. His interpretation went a little overboard, but the basic aspect of it was very solid, and we were asked to sort of examine it and give an expert opinion, and we actually sided with his views. So the internet has really opened up the ability, I think, especially for non-professional historians to do, you know, incredible things and find things and resources and connect to people in ways that they might not.
Yeah, well, actually, there were three ways I used the internet that helped me thread the story together. The first was that IRED has put the Common Council files searchable by keyword that I could
right.
go in and find everything related to the cemetery, which I then downloaded those files, then went to the library, read the microfilm, made copies of the microfilm, collated the copies. Chronologically, it revealed exactly, you know, what was happening. And then, more pointedly for this project, is when the Chicago Tribune put their historical archives online.
The ProQuest.
Exactly.
The bill, yes.
And
yes,
that's how I was able to read
huge.
The newspaper stories in the order that they happened,
yes.
and then watch the story change until people were telling a whole entirely different story.
Yeah.
As
well,
I'm reading it from decade to
right.
decade.
Right. And I mean, of course, newspapers are one of the great resources for historians, but newspapers are newspapers. You having those city council
right. Primary right.
is great, because you can look at it and say, you know, this isn't, you know, connect. And even with, in this case of Constable Quinn, I mean, we had four or five different newspapers reporting on the same thing
mm-hmm.
with slightly
mm-hmm.
different versions.
Right.
So, you know, caveat emptor with newspapers, we you know, historians, sometimes that's all you have, and it is a great resource to give you, you know, specifics and details. Sometimes you wouldn't find anything else, but, you know, you really have to match it against some other kind of evidence.
Well, and that was the gist of how the project started, because the stories that were being relayed through the newspapers were so obviously different from the stories at the time when they happened that I
right.
had read the primary sources for. And so it was the changing story that hid the information that led to the project. And then the third thing that the internet helped me with, which I didn't even realize as I started the project, and were actually continuing to appear online as I was doing this research, is the Google Book search site, where you can search by keyword and find 19th century books to the page where that word shows up. So I found references to David Kennison in books from the 1890s that the reference wasn't even indexed in that book. And then I was able to read the actual page from this 19th century book online on my computer.
I haven't used Google Books, but that's incredible. That's really
And so I found things that were referenced in books from that time that never even were indexed or reported anywhere else that then became part of the story because I'm interested in the stories. And so most of this was done on my laptop, just sitting and, you know, searching and finding and then threading. And then next thing I knew, I could actually watch the story change and morph until it became what we know today, which is essentially that, or the way we understand it, until there's the surprise that all the bodies were removed from the cemetery.
Right.
So beginning with where we're sitting, which is on the cemetery, the original cemetery grounds.
Here we are.
The Historical Society was built here in 1931, and right. At that time there were newspaper articles in the equivalent of the Chicago Tribune showing the bones that were being excavated along with as the foundation for this building was being excavated. And so there are stories that I came across, and photographs of a skeleton that was sort of reassembled on the sidewalk at the time with, like, boys, you know, in knickers watching this.
The spectacle, yeah.
The spectacle at that time. And then the addition in 1980, apparently there was also something, although the story was much more shrouded. There was just a reference, but there wasn't the kind of story that accompanied the 1931-32 finding. And then the major story, because there's so much information about it, because it's more recent and because I've personally spoken with people who were involved, is the 1998 excavation for the parking facility for the History Museum.
Right.
And so what was your position in the museum at that time?
98, I think I was deputy director for collections and research, so I was head of the collections division at that point. Not as active in the administration as I am now. I mean, certainly I was aware of it, and that project was headed by our vice president for finance, Bob Nauert. And I know Bob talked to me about, you know, who could we go to for assistance, and I had pointed him to Helen Sclair, the cemetery lady, who I knew from her work in the research center. And I believe he went to her and got some, and my vague recollection is she confirmed that, yes, you're going to find human remains. We also knew from casual conversations with park district people that they said, oh, yeah, you do anything over here, you're going to find some bones. I mean, that was what they had told us. I don't know how Bob connected with David Keene, but I was very happy. My background is in historical archaeology, and I was very happy that he was hiring a professional archaeologist to work on this. And as I said, I wasn't actively involved in it, sort of watched it from afar. But I know the story that at least circulated through the building when they found the iron coffin was that somebody had called the police and that, you know, there were six cop cars that converged and they were afraid that this person had cholera and they were impounding the body. So that was sort of the story that spread. We were also, I knew that they did find human remains and that they were treated respectfully.
You're talking about the skeletal remains, not the iron coffin.
Yes, when they found other remains, they were collected, that these remains were gathered, and I don't know if they were, you know, placed in one new casket or several, depending on the quantity, but they were properly interred somewhere.
Those are the skeletal remains that I think are in Springfield, actually.
Well, maybe. I thought they were reburied. That was what I was told.
So, and your story about the six police cars converging is also the first I've heard of that story.
That's, you know, and maybe I don't know where that came from.
But all of this is interesting to me because this is how stories get disseminated and then how we understand history, and even 10-year-old history becomes about.
And there was did not the discovery of the Iron Coffin make it into the Trib as an article?
I did not come across
okay.
that, no.
Maybe it didn't. I know they were we were concerned about bad press.
But what's bad press about history? That would be my first question as to why something like this would not be reported.
I think, you're right. There are, and I don't want to mention any names, but there have been some reporters that have sort of, they look for a way, you know, to get under the cultural facade of being we serve the public to like the dirt. You know?
There's so many bad puns in this
yes.
project. So is it to assume liability upon somebody then, or what would be the
problem? I just think you might have seen a headline, historical society disturbs the dead, or you know this kind of thing of like, well, why are you doing that? And you're building a parking structure, and this is a cemetery, there are human remains there, this is a terrible thing you're doing.
And so what's your stand on that?
My stand on that?
Yeah.
This was a cemetery that, supposedly was, the human remains were removed. I mean, if one of the things you learn as an urban historian is, as cities in this country, and I imagine Europe, have formed, cemeteries were always on the outside of the city limits. And there were all kinds of suspicions about, you hear descriptions of miasmas and these, health problems, and it was all very, sort of undefined, but people did not want.
Well, North Avenue was the northern edge of the city,
so
why they put the cemetery.
Bingo, you have this thing. But of course, as cities expanded, the cemeteries were valuable land, and so it was very common then to remove and the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, at least, the legend is that during the Great Chicago Fire, that there were open grave sites here, and this is one of the places that people hid
mm-hmm.
From the fire, because the fire did burn up this far. So I think, already this as a cemetery had been disturbed. I think I personally don't have a problem with it, as long as you do it, properly.
And respectfully.
Respectfully. And I think, again, I was proud of the museum, the Historical Society at that time, for approaching it that way. And so I didn't feel like we had anything. But again, people get weird about the press and, they want to hide stuff. No, really, we had nothing to hide.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with that. I mean, in some ways, it was a great opportunity to talk about how you do this and why this is important, and the fact that, the past is all around us if you just look for it. And it's sometimes in positions or in situations that interfere with what you want to do in
mm-hmm.
the present or in the
mm-hmm.
future.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to accept that. You have to deal with it. And you look at a place like Rome, there's a reason why they don't have a subway there.
In Athens, too. Yeah.
Because, you can't dig and not
anywhere.
Find
right.
the part of the history. So in America, we have this, very, people, I think, love history, but they don't want to be burdened by the past. They don't want to get in their way. And so you do have, especially with respect to things like architectural preservation, we don't have a very good record.
Mm.
A lot of things have been torn down because they were in the way.
In this city. Yeah.
So, human remains are special because, again, I think you just have to treat of any culture, you have to treat them with respect, and you have to give acknowledge if there's a connection to a particular community, whether it's a religious or an ethnic or a racial group. You have to acknowledge that they have an interest in that. If not outright ownership, they have an interest, and you have to engage them and involve them. And I think that's really important. And again, it's a wonderful opportunity to make the connection between the past, the present, and the future. And so we shouldn't shy away from these things. We do have one set of human remains in our collection, and we believe these are the remains of Jean Lalime. Mr. Lalime was, I believe it was in 1806 that he was murdered. The alleged murderer was John Kinsey, who initially had been a rival with DuSable, and then when DuSable left and he sold his homestead to Lalime, who I believe bought it not personally but was the agent for a fur trading concern in Detroit. But then Lalime was at least perceived as a rival for Kinsey in his own trading enterprise. And, you know, Kinsey claims it was, you know, that was a fight, it was a, you know, self-defense, whatever. He did leave town for a few months and then eventually came back. These remains were discovered during some construction along the north side of the river, about where Pioneer Court is today, which is the site of DuSable's homestead, and then Kinsey eventually getting that property. And the story is that Kinsey was required almost as a punishment or penance to care for Lalime's grave that was on that site. And so it's conjecture. I don't think, and again, this might be your next project. Yeah, okay. We can put you onto something really good here, right, to sort of figure out if these are Lalime's remains, okay, and the location and all that. We have had a couple of forensic anthropologists, you know, look at them. There's not a complete set of remains, and they were very interested. We were told by the Cook County medical inspector that because this was the first reported murder in Cook County, that they had jurisdiction over these, which is like, great, fine, legal, you know. Mm-hmm. From an ethical standpoint, I personally feel very strongly that these remains should not be in the museum. You know, I have my own personal reasons, having been an archaeologist, having worked in an anthropology museum, having seen a lot of human remains, which I didn't feel were being stored in a respectful way. And that, you know, upset me. These, I would say, are not, well, they're wrapped up. I guess these are not, when I first got here, they were in this little box, almost like a reliquary. And I thought that was kind of spooky and weird and everything.
But that seems very Victorian, because you have that, that's reproduced in this book.
Yeah, it's very, very Victorian, mm-hmm, and I, you know.
Which looked at the dead in a very different way than we
did. Sure, because they had hair jewelry. Yeah. I mean, mourning was very much, and having, you know, the remains, I mean, death was very much a part of life.
Right.
And we have divorced ourselves from death.
Exactly.
And I think we've lost something, you know, in that. But ideally, I would love to return these remains to the family. If we can actually identify that they are Lalime's, and we can identify that there are descendants. And that, I think, is a long shot because of the nature of Chicago at that time, which was a very, very loose
and movable, everything.
Yeah,
was,
very fluid, yeah, society at that time. And, you know, we, again, just like DuSable, we try, and there are people who try to learn more about DuSable, and, you know, a lot of it gets down to conjecture. Mm-hmm. Just certain things we just don't know, we won't know. And Lalime might be even less, mm-hmm, because DuSable was a very prominent person in Chicago.
Well, and even John Kinsey features, interestingly, in my project, because his remains were moved three times. And it was not at all uncommon to be moving remains around.
No,
and it seems distasteful and odd for us today to be thinking about that, but that's probably part of the creepiness of thinking about the fact that there are still bones there, here in Lincoln Park. But just the whole idea of the fluidity and the moving, and that people would disinter, and they may have even disinterred if they removed the remains to Graceland, then decided they'd rather be in Rose Hill.
Right, but you know, you also, I mean, there's an interesting aspect to human remains too in the 19th century, which was the fear, the human remains being desecrated. So, for instance, somebody like Pullman, you know, is buried under 10 feet of concrete, mm-hmm, because the fear was that, you know, people. And so, you know, it's this, you know, just as powerful as a symbol as, like, pulling the statue of a leader down, you know, when they've fallen, the desecration of somebody's bones, especially somebody who's so despised, was a great fear to the family, probably because they knew, you know, that disinterring was common and you could find people who would do it and nobody would, you know, think about it. And it is that other whole aspect, which is really fascinating.
It is. There's so many different facets of this that I found interesting in ways that I hadn't even thought of. The most of which was having to do with the how long it took the disinterring to happen. As Rose Hill and Graceland were established, as the Milliman Tract lawsuit forced the disinterring of a big 12-acre section of the city cemetery, for a 20-year period, graves were being disinterred and bodies were being carried up and down Clark Street, up Clark Street.
They started here in what, about 1864?
Well, 65? In 1859, when Rose Hill Cemetery opened,
they started.
They were given the first opportunity to remove, to get equal plots to start to remove to the new graveyard, which was, you know, 7 miles outside of city limits at that time, in the town of Lakeview. And the following year is when Calvary Cemetery and Graceland Cemetery opened, and so there were more options. So people just by themselves were given the opportunity to remove their loved ones from the city cemetery and reinter them in the new rural cemeteries up in the north side.
Right, and that, of course, you did have that shift, too, from the cemeteries and the cities being seen as these, you know, kind of places with, as I said, miasma and vapors, and to being, you know, these beautiful parks.
Right.
That whole movement, the, you know, the sort of rural park cemetery movement that started in New England. And I know when my son was young, we had a picnic up in Rose Hill, and he just loved, you know, romping around, and people, we got some stares, but it was what it was designed to be for, you know.
I read that the opening day in Rose Hill there were 8,000 picnickers that went there, and of course nobody was buried there yet, and it looked like a park. And I've loved this irony that they wanted the cemetery to be a park here, and they wanted the park to be a cemetery there, and this kind of this tweaking back and forth of making these pleasure grounds, you know, or, you know, places to memorialize or to picnic or to rest, or it's for the living essentially anyway, you know, the way it works out. But so there was a lawsuit in 1866 that the city had to give up this 12-acre plot because it was determined that they had acquired it illegally, so they needed to vacate the grounds. And so that was the big surge of, let's get these, we don't own this ground, so we had to
remove the bodies.
And so that was the big surge. And so starting in 1866, even though for 6 years pieces of, you know, every once in a while there would be a hole dug and the bodies would be removed, but starting in 1866 and then going until 1869 when it became the Lincoln Park grounds, and then the city handed it over to the park commissioners, and then the Chicago Fire came in, and so this was this ongoing thing for 20 years that it was, I mean, an entire generation of people saw graves being dug, people being disinterred and trucked at night up Clark Street. And so it was just part of what was going on in the city, which is, I think, why it wasn't even reported that often, because all of a sudden...
This was normal.
Exactly. It wasn't news.
Was there any... was there any charges of any kind of graft or fraud with respect of the people who were... When they buried the Confederate soldiers who died at Camp Douglas, there was a huge scandal about... I don't know if he was the camp commandant or who, somebody, but the... Or maybe just the undertaker, but he had these exorbitant prices for coffee. I mean, he was just, you know, it
fleecing
was fleecing. So I don't know if you encountered any of that or charges of that.
There were a couple of ordinances or acts that the Common Council put out to warn the people from dealing with anyone other than the city officials when it came to disinterring their bodies. So I don't know if there were people that were, you know, taking it upon themselves to take money from the public to dig up a grave. But because there were also earlier people that were taking upon themselves to dig their own graves for their family members, you know, and getting in front of the sexton's duties. So, okay, well, this was very interesting. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me and for sharing these wonderful stories.
You know, as I said, I know a little bit about a lot of aspects of Chicago history, And it's always fun for me to meet someone like you who knows more about an aspect, and I learn a lot from it, you know, and that's great for me. And then I have a resource to send people to say, you know, talk to Pamela.
Add me to your Rolodex.
Which is great. You know, that's one of the things I do is I try to connect the people, just like I'm going to connect you with John Swenson, who I think you will really enjoy.
So talking about David Kennison.
Yes, David Kennison.
Well, thank you again for all your help.
My pleasure.